Fabian, how are you? Thank you for joining us on this episode of Cloud Conversations.
Thank you, Roo. I'm good. How are you today?
Yeah, no, all good here. Better now that I'm joined with yourself. You've been on fire lately with regards to your blog and all that other good stuff. I obviously know who you are. Do you want to give folks joining us, maybe new to you for the first time, give them a little bit of an introduction for yourself?
Yes, of course. Yeah, my name is Fabian Bader. I'm from Hamburg, Germany, and I have a blog. It's called cloudbrothers.info, and I write about all things that has anything to do with cloud security, identity, and I also have some old posts about like Exchange, but this is way back when I did that. So it's like a diary where I have all my knowledge published and hope anybody who wants to know it as well can find it. And yes, I'm now almost 1 year MVP. Very honored about that. And otherwise I work as a consultant. So I got to do the great stuff out there with our customers.
Awesome. Good stuff. And yeah, I've got, when I go into these shows, I have like pages of notes and I've got like two pages of stuff to talk to you about based on your blog. I'll maybe pick off though, was one thing you mentioned there, because you mentioned Exchange, right? And from what I've seen, a lot of folks now who focus on M365 and Azure security, they kind of have that history of being an Exchange administrator and things like that. How did you end up where you are just now?
Oh, this is a long story, but let me try to keep it a bit short. I now work for like over 20 years in IT. I did some work in my first company where I also learned. In Germany, it's called Ausbildung, so a 3-year apprenticeship where you learn everything about a topic, in that case, IT. And yeah, I've been in my first company for about 9 years in total. And I did from like installing REC servers, building the first VMware, then it was called Cloud, but VMware virtualization environment there, doing Citrix, doing networking. I had the opportunity to look into all those aspects and have a touch of everything there. It was really great because having this broad understanding of how IT works and how different things work under the hood, it really helped over the years. And after that, I switched to MSSP here in Hamburg. And yeah, there I more focused on the whole Windows, Microsoft, Azure, later Azure, but in the beginning, Active Directory stuff. And yeah, and there I started as a system administrator. Later I was a systems engineer there, and mostly working with our customers to implement the solutions for them, and then later on also maintaining them. And yeah, over the years, like security always is a part of what you do if you want to do it in IT correct. So if you don't want to do admin and have your SAN open for anybody, then you have to think about how you can do security in a better way. And yeah, over the years, I found my niche in like identity and especially Active Directory, like tiering, later on doing ADFS, Azure AD Connect, stuff like that, where it slowly moved to the cloud. And as I said, I'm based in Germany, so it was a very slow moving thing here. In other regions of the world, I think the cloud adoption was quite faster than it is here in Germany, but still, I managed there. And then after a few years, I switched to totally doing consulting outside, worked in bigger projects in like Exchange migrations, identity migrations, stuff like that. And yeah, then I focused in on the whole Microsoft security suite. So then it was still Azure ATP, and the whole Advanced Threat Protection Suite, and now Defender, as it is renamed now. And yeah, so this is what I do for the last few years now. And now I work as a cybersecurity consultant, as it's called now.
Nice. Love that. That's such a sexy title, you know, cybersecurity. It's always got such a ring to it, right? I'll tell you what, one thing I want to pick up that you mentioned there is because you mentioned that product by its own name. You mentioned Azure ATP, right? Now called Microsoft Defender for Identity. And you're always quite good at sharing product updates with that on Twitter. Because the reason I bring this up is I had a discussion with a customer recently, is there's been a lot of change of guidance coming from Microsoft with regards to, I don't want to say best practices for securing domain controllers, but the big shift has been you can now kind of let your domain controllers talk to the internet, right? And that scares off a few folks. So with that in mind, you know, ideally we don't want our domains to talk to the internet, but we want to allow some communication for Defender for Identity. What are the benefits of Defender for Identity? Why should folks trust the guidance here to roll it out?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest advantages, if you have a complete Microsoft Defender for Identity rollout in your environment, is the deep insight you get into your environment. I've been to enough companies that are like, yeah, we have some logging solution. So we have an agent on the domain controller, it sends some logs over there to our logstash or whatever name you want to put there. And that's great, because now it's there. But I haven't seen that many companies that then use this information to really do stuff with it. So maybe some had some advanced system administrators that were like, yeah, I can check for some sign-in events, stuff like that. That's really great. But this is, in most cases, the advanced usage that I have seen. And with Microsoft Defender for Identity, this is just something you can also do. All those events, you can look for sign-in events and stuff. But what's the benefit here is you're not only looking at event logs, you're looking at audit events, you're looking at raw network data. Of course, not you are looking at that, but Microsoft is doing that for you. And this really helps because it's like an abstraction of what's happening in your environment. If you have somebody in your environment doing stuff that might be a bit shady or it might be an attacker, you now have the ability to get an alert on that. And you don't have to write this alert for the newest, like, petit potam thing out there, or you don't have to follow the people on Twitter and see what is now the hot shit in IT security, because Microsoft has teams doing exactly that. They implement new features all the time. And you follow me on Twitter and see how often I post about a new version of MDI, and it's not only just, yeah, some maintenance in the background, this also happens, but in most cases, there are no new features like every 2 months, new detections coming in. And this is, I think, the real benefit for companies deploying MDI, is to getting this deep insight, the alert capabilities, without having to have the know-how to write that themselves. If you have a big team and you can like gather all this information in a CM, then you have this capability like 5 or 10 years ago maybe. But if you don't have that team, and most companies don't, then you need somebody who is doing it for you. And in that case, Microsoft does a really good job. And about this, letting the domain controllers talk to the internet, I think you don't have to, or you shouldn't think about it like talking to the internet. You still should shut down browsers on your domain controller, stuff like that shouldn't be allowed to run either. And definitely not connecting to something like Webmail or Google or Bing, because you only should allow really those IPs and ports that are needed. And with MDI, you can do that. There are ports, published by Microsoft, and you can say, okay, I only want to allow those on my firewall. Or even if you have a proxy, you can tunnel it over the proxy and only allow those specific websites. And if you have a proxy, please disable SSL interception, but that's another thing. But you can really streamline it to a few communication channels that are going outside. And it's always an outbound connection. This is also important. You are not exposing your domain controller to the internet. You are allowing it to connect to certain endpoints in the Microsoft ecosystem and to send information to those endpoints. I think that's the important thing that every customer has to understand. You're not allowing it to talk to the internet in a whole, but to some services out there.
Right. And because of the outbound nature of it, I'm not going to have my domain controller show up on some port scan somewhere, right? This is purely...
Yes, correct.
Yes, okay.
So it's not like you want to see your domain controller on Shodan tomorrow. And this is definitely not what's happening if you're allowing it to communicate to MDI services.
Right, understood. Yeah. No, yeah, that makes sense. And geez, talk about a bad way to start your day if your domain controller showed up there. and so when you kind of started to specialize in the identity security and things, that would have been part of... That will have happened at the same time that folks were moving from on-prem and they're moving to AAD. And then they're really joining the two through the hybrid process, right? And that seems to be a common attack weakness that a lot of organizations face. You know, when you read the debriefs of ransomware attacks, there's usually some kind of compromise where maybe they started in 365 and were able to laterally move to on-premises or vice versa, right? And I know that I haven't had time to read it yet, but you just published an article about moving from on-premises to, I guess, owning a global administrator account. What are some of the risks that exist in the hybrid identity model, and how do folks secure themselves against it?
I think the most important takeaway is that in most cases, you currently, at the moment, don't see this cloud to on-prem that often. That is because the on-premises environments, they are like been there for 20 years. If you're looking at Active Directory, most companies who are early adopters now can celebrate like 20 years Active Directory in their environment. And if they haven't kept up with the security events around Active Directory, then there will be big open doors that an attacker could abuse. So this is in most cases the easy target, the legacy infrastructure, as we sometimes call it. But this is something every large organization still has. So it's not really legacy, but it's there and you have to protect it.
And so just to clarify something on that then, because I see there are some folks out there who are very, you know, they're very cloud first, on-prem is all bad. But to me, there's nothing inherently insecure about on-prem Active Directory. It's just that over the last two decades, that's a long time for misconfiguration, for poor configuration, for configuration drift. Is that accurate, or is there something inherently dangerous about on-prem AD?
I wouldn't say there is something inherently bad, because there is stuff you can do, but what you said is correct. So we have 20 years of misconfiguration, and at some point also we have 20 years of not having ideal settings. So there are default settings to this day in Active Directory that are not by the security guidelines that Microsoft is publishing themselves with security baseline, stuff like that. And also there's NTLM. And over the last 2 years, I think we have seen so many NTLM relay attacks that it now really gets to the point where you say, okay, this protocol, it has to go away. But on the other hand, you have like 500 applications that are like, yeah, Kerberos, I don't know what that is. And when looking at Kerberos, there are other caveats there. I think with cloud environments, we have the ability to use the knowledge and security know-how over the last 20, 30 years made in IT. and now can apply that to a completely new infrastructure. And this is a chance for many companies to be like, okay, let's get, it's not really greenfield, but let's start on a open slate and do something more secure. You will never do this in that scope in your on-premises environment if you don't have like a project only focusing on securing your AD, doing tier concepts, stuff like that. And most companies, they won't do this because they still have some 2003 server running for this and that application because it's needed. And this shows you where those gaps in security and posture management on premises are. And in the cloud, I think many companies can adopt a more secure environment more easy than they can do on premises.
Right. And okay.
Definitely, I would say try to go to the cloud with new applications, use stuff like OAuth, where you have some kind of identity platform, Azure AD, where you have MFA, conditional access, stuff like that, that can protect you. This is all stuff we don't have currently on premises. So you see Microsoft and the community always talking about MFA on premise, and there are solutions that implement it for like RDP. But what if you have opened the PowerShell remote port? There is no MFA. And suddenly the attack path is right beneath RDP and it goes to another port where there is no MFA. Stuff like this is really complicated on premises to have all those possible ways. There are great tools like Bloodhound and stuff like that that can help you to focus and get a hold of why or what are my biggest pain points in my environment, and you should do that. But your best approach is getting your clients out of the Active Directory completely, move them to Azure AD, because this will take a huge attack surface away. As I said in the beginning, the attackers don't go from cloud to on-prem that often, but what they do is from the internet in your environment with stuff like macros, other things. Now we see OneNote is the new hot shit out there, and everybody is sending malicious OneNote files. And this is dangerous because, of course, there is communication from the internet, and we have Teams, we have mail, and we all need it. And then we have users who are maybe even security aware, but the attackers also get better. They have stuff that looks really good, and somebody will click on it. And it will happen, and it's okay that it happens because nobody can be on alert 100% of the time. It always will happen. And to minimize the attack surface in this case, so if you have your normal Windows client within your domain, this means you have direct sight to your domain controller because you need it. Otherwise, you won't get your Kerberos ticket, stuff like that. Then you have direct sight to many, many application servers. And in most cases, the admin that is doing some remote help is also admin on one of those servers. So in this moment, somebody has compromised this machine. An admin is logging in because, hey, I got a problem. There's some pop-up whatever. Now this password and this account is compromised, and the attacker can then lateral move to the next server. There's maybe some admin terminal server. Everybody's there. All the credentials are there. Yay, happy. And now the and this is the way somebody can move laterally through your environment. Of course, this is all possible in the cloud as well. If you don't look that you contain those identities as well and restrict where they have access. But the same attack scenario with an Azure AD joint client has much less impact because only the user is compromised. And even if the admin is connecting there with like TeamViewer or something, the credentials aren't gone. And even with RDP, maybe the credentials are gone, but still the attacker cannot connect to some server or to the Azure AD because there is hopefully MFA. And of course, we all know MFA. We are talking about it because we are security consultants and we are security aware. Many users out there don't do it. In the digital defense report by Microsoft, I think over 70% are not using MFA for privileged users. This is really bad. So there's also enough room for misconfiguration, and it will happen, and we have to do this work in the cloud as well. But I think we are at a good point to get out some of the attack surface from those legacy systems to newer systems and contain it on a smaller scale.
Right. Yeah. The number you just cited about privileged users not having MFA on Azure AD, that's kind of staggering, right? Because you kind of think, oh, well, everybody knows it's common sense, MFA, all the things and all that kind of stuff. But obviously that's not happening. And I guess they're in a situation where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. If Microsoft just flicked a switch and said, okay, all privileged roles always need MFA on every tenant in the world, folks would be like, hey, slow down, not ready for it yet.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I get so, because one of the things you mentioned there is it all is the, when we're, with regards to, you know, compromising those on-premises identities, it's all about, or at least a lot of the attacks are, you know, is to do with grabbing those hash and hashes, grabbing those tickets. When you move to the cloud, you still kind of have that with regards to grabbing the PRT, grabbing the cookie, et cetera, right? So is it, I guess where I'm going to, what here is it makes it uniquely dangerous for that on-prem device compared to that Azure AD joint device? Is it because one thing that comes to mind off the top of the head for me is it's pretty common you would see cached domain admin credentials on a random user's workstation. Quite rare you'd see the same from an Azure AD joined device. Is that the right line of thinking?
I think that's what I would hope is there. And of course, you are right. There are still exactly those problems. So as long as you have with your normal user global admin permissions, then we have the same problem, because then your ticket is maybe in some Teams cache or somewhere else, and it can be grabbed by an attacker if he or she has access over your laptop. So yeah, definitely there are risks, but we have better capabilities in the cloud to protect ourselves. So
okay.
Stuff like conditional access policies, they allow us to restrict that administrator is only coming from a certain workstation, and this quite easy. And also we can say, yeah, you can come, but only if you do MFA. Last year, Microsoft enabled us to say, yeah, not that MFA, you need better MFA. You need like FIDO2 security, something like that, where we hope that phishing is, currently it's called phishing resistant. And from the technology, yeah, currently it is. Maybe some attack will come out in a few years, and we don't know that. But currently, we can up the game really easy because there are the capabilities built in. If we are looking at on-premises, yes, we can also do stuff like that. Especially, I talked about the tiering concept of Microsoft. Now it's replaced by the enterprise access model, but still it's the same logic behind it. And the enterprise access model just goes into the cloud as well. So Microsoft just changed it from, okay, we have an Active Directory to now we have a cloud and stuff like that. We must evolve with it. And the idea behind that is the user, if it's compromised, doesn't have administrative permissions on a server. And also, if you as an administrator are connecting to this machine, you're not using your administrator. You're using some kind of administrator that is only allowed to connect to clients. And that way you can separate where those hashes are and
right.
where the attacker can move laterally. And there's also stuff like authentication silos, where you can define those users are only allowed to log on those specific machines. And I don't mean just like policy deny lock on, but really on a Kerberos level. And this is really great stuff, but it's not really implemented out there because it's hard. It's really complicated doing it. You have to implement something like a privileged access workstation to use something like authentication silos. And in the cloud, it's a bit easier. Still, there's a requirement where you should use something like a privileged access workstation. But in reality, most of the users are using hopefully something like MFA, FIDO, and this is really better than nothing. And in all those cases, it's about how easy can you get security. And if you start somewhere new in the cloud, it's easier to implement those steps, those guardrails. And also, you don't have like 15 years of legacy IT behind you saying, no, 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 you can't do this because this will break. We don't know, but it will break something. Yeah. Hands off. So we have seen this with Microsoft disabling basic auth for the Exchange, SharePoint services, stuff like that. And Microsoft themselves had to move this date again and again. And then they were, okay, now we disable it, but you can enable it. But now, since January, it's over, with some exceptions.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to cut off old technology because it's used. And people are not always looking at, oh, what's the next shiny thing? And let's move there. It's more like, okay, you're using this and it works. Why change? And then you have to educate why we should we change it. In some cases, Microsoft has to make those hard decisions. And in the cloud, they seem to be more willing to do that. There are enough settings on premises where they somehow got so much pushback from customers that they decided first to move like LWS signing a year later, 2 years later. And now they are saying, yeah, no, you do it when you do it. And in the cloud, they seem to be more vigilant and, okay, no, we are going to do this. And maybe it takes us 2-3 years longer than we anticipated, but we will do it in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, it always feels like they're kind of negotiating with the customer, right? It's like, we'll do it here. Oh, wait, no, we'll give you a bit more time. We'll do it a bit more time. But it comes eventually. Whereas you look at on-premises and you look at, well, NTLM is a good example. And I know that there is stuff happening. If you follow the right people on Twitter, you do see, you know, there are these kind of discussions happening within Microsoft about how do we eventually, I don't want to say get rid of it, but there's stuff going on there, right? But it just seems like when you move to the cloud, that's your clean slate, right? And I guess maybe by the very nature of the fact that if you have applications that are in Azure AD as enterprise apps, you don't have to worry about that legacy baggage just by the nature of the fact they're enterprise apps compared to on-premises where you might not necessarily know how that thing works, right? And you just kind of want to stay away and don't touch it. Let's just not risk anything, right? One of the things that you mentioned there was phishing resistant MFA, and you did a great blog and also a session at the 365 Security and Compliance User Group about, I think it was just called Why Using a FIDO2 Key is Important. What is it specifically about FIDO2 compared to, I don't know, the authenticator app that makes it so much more significant for privileged users?
Yeah, the biggest change, I think, in FIDO2 security keys is really how they store the key and how they communicate with the Azure AD to authenticate you and say, yeah, this is really you and not somebody else. And over the last like 30 days or days, years in security and in IT, we did something. We said, okay, you will send me your name. And then you will send me your password. And I, as your identity provider, I will look up and say, yeah, I got your name here. And let's see. Oh, yeah, I also got your password. And if we are looking at password breaches, there are still enough people or services out there that are doing exactly this. They are looking at your password. And hopefully they have it hashed or even salted and stuff like that. So everything that prevents an attacker who gains access to this material to extract it and use it against you, because they might be able to figure out your password from this. And since you used it at 10 other places, they can use it then there as well. And this all changes with FIDO 2. And it's not something completely new. If you have done like authentication with a smart card, then this is exactly the same level of security, but much easier, because a smart card, it always involved, I need some PKI in my environment, somebody has to maintain it, they have to secure it, stuff like that. Just to give you a certificate on your smart card that you put in your smart card reader, you unlock it by a PIN, and then you can sign in. That's really great stuff, because in this case, on this smart card, you have a private key. And this private key, it cannot be extracted, not read out from this smart card. It's bound to this specific hardware. And with FIDO 2, we got the same thing, but much easier from a user perspective. So you go to a website like AKA MFA setup, and then it's like, okay, please enter your or register your MFA method, and you'll say, okay, I want to do security key. And then your browser is like, yeah, please plug it in, and you just put it in, say, okay, give you enter your PIN for this key, and then you press a few times. And after that, you just put in a name for it, and that's all you as an end user have to do. And what happens on a technical term is your FIDO key now created a private key, and it sent this, not this private key, but the public part of this private key to Azure AD and said, okay, this is me. If you find somebody with this public key, then this is me. And the next time you are now going to Azure AD and you want to authenticate there, Azure AD is like, okay, how do you want to do it? And you're like, yeah, I want to do it by a FIDO 2 key. Okay, no problem. You will send the username still. But the next thing is not, you don't send any password. And you don't even send your public key. Microsoft will send you a number used once, nonce. So it's just a number. They will send that to you, and you will sign it with your private key. And to do that, you will have to unlock your FIDO key. This could be like biometrics or PIN or whatever. And you have to touch it. And this unlocking and touching is making sure that you are you and that there is a human behind it. And also, it is required to access the private key on this FIDO key. And again, now the FIDO key is not sending out the private key, but they are signing the nonce that they got from Microsoft with that private key on the FIDO key. The key never leaves this hardware. And this nonce is then sent back to Microsoft. Microsoft can then look at the nonce. Ah, there's a signature. Compare the signature to your public certificate. And if that matches, then they are like, okay, here you go. Now you have an access token, primary refresh token. Go ahead, have fun. And this is really complicated in the back end. But for the user, it's just like, okay, just click here, put it in, and it works. And the most important part is there's no communication of any secret in this. The secret stays on your device. And that's the same with Windows Hello for Business. if you do Windows Hello for Business, it will do exactly this. It will create a private certificate on your device, private key, private hopefully in a TPM, because then it is really protected and it cannot be extracted. And then you can sign the norms and stuff like that. And for the user, it's just like, okay, I know that from my Android, iPhone, whatever, I can unlock it by a PIN, I can unlock it by my camera. And this is really great because it's total convenience for the end user and a big step up in security for the administrators.
I heard recently FIDO2 keys described as TPM on a stick, which I don't know how accurate that is, but it's quite, I kind of like it as an analogy because, like you said, the key there is that your private key, the secret, it never leaves the hardware, right?
Yeah.
Presumably Windows Hello for Business being the same as protected by.
Those keys are especially made for that. They are, you cannot open them up and put some, like electrode to read out the key material in there. They are made that if you try to do this, you will destroy it.
Right.
And that's a really good analogy. So TPM on a stick, yeah, that's good. That's really good.
I need to remember who it was done that so I can give them credit from now on. I'm just going to steal it though. And I guess, you know, because you mentioned a couple things. You mentioned earlier on that there's no, it's phishing resistant for now. Who knows what the future is going to hold, right? And you also mentioned the fact that by design, as soon as you start tampering with the physical hardware it's designed, that it will, you know, you'll break it before you get around it. I guess, like I said, who knows what the future holds, but the point is that dramatically increases the cost of an attack, right? Because at the minute, again, going back to the article on your blog, which we'll link to, called Why Using a FIDO2 Key is Important, the cost at the minute for an adversary in the middle attack using something like EvilJinx is tiny, right? It's almost zero cost. Is that, you know, a few bucks a month on some on a Debian server somewhere, right?
If you buy a vServer like DigitalOcean, what is it, five quid a month?
Yeah.
So, and then you have everything you need.
Yep, absolutely. And so if we kind of, I don't want to say it's the gold standard because that's such a loaded term, but if we regard FIDO2 as good, right? We regard the MFA Authenticator app as kind of good. Let's say, well, I'm not going to be able to roll out FIDO2 keys to 10,000 of my users overnight. But I still want to protect against adversary in the middle attacks. What are some of the things, like, can conditional access help that at all, or are we screwed?
Oh, yeah. No, we still have some capabilities there. So from an attacker perspective, what you have to do in this case is first you have to lure your victim to some kind of phishing site. So definitely there we have capabilities with MD365 for Office and stuff like that, where we can go in and try to figure out, okay, is this site malicious or not? And Microsoft gets better at that all the time. But still, if the attacker manages to get somebody there, this IP address from this server will be the sign-in IP address of this user. And if this user is normally logging in from Hamburg, Germany, but next time it's from like Singapore, that might be something where we want to intervene. And this is where Azure Active Directory Identity Protection can come in to play and say, okay, this is a risky user. We want to block him because this kind of sign-in events, this is not normal. It's an impossible travel or anomalous token. And we can then raise the bar of the risk level for that user. And if it reaches a certain risk level, then we will block it. Right. On the other hand, what we also can do, and this is really good if you have a tightly integrated Windows in Azure AD and Intune, you can check for device compliance. Is the machine that the users coming from compliant. And as soon as you do that, the attacker cannot do the man-in-the-middle attack again, because it cannot relay this compliance status to his server and through the attacker channel to Azure AD. So this will also break the attack.
Great.
But as we know it, in many cases, you have guest users, stuff like that. They also have access, and they don't have a device from you. And in that case, you might want to do something like the Defender for Cloud Apps, put them behind a reverse proxy, still not mitigating this attack, but you can maybe prevent the attacker from downloading stuff from the service, like SharePoint or whatever this user has to access. But I think the best way to currently prevent your users to sign in is using Windows Hello for Business, requesting device compliance in some kind, and also, or if you still have hybrid environment for your endpoints as well, requesting the hybrid status of this device. This can also help, because also something that cannot be easily sent through this attacker. And yeah, this really helps.
Okay, so I'm going to, just to dig into that a little bit more then, if my conditional access is kind of wide open and all I'm really doing is asking for MFA, the adversary in the middle can steal that MFA claim, use it in their own environment, and I've satisfied my MFA requirement for conditional access. So just to be clear, if I require a compliant device or a hybrid join device, they can't steal that. They cannot steal the fact that you have that. They can only steal the MFA claim. Is that right?
Correct. So okay. they cannot even steal the MFA claim, because conditional access will not give them a session cookie. So what happens in those attacks is conditional access, you authenticate, username, password, and then comes conditional access. So your username and your password, they still will be phished in those things. But now conditional access comes into play. And conditional access is like, yeah, okay, nice. I know your password is correct. Everything is great. But now we want to do this and that I will give you an access token. And before this happens, I will have to check for your device compliance or your hybrid status.
Gotcha.
And because compliance and hybrid status are also bound to certificates, we again have this thing, okay, certificates, they cannot be relayed over the man-in-the-middle proxy, at least currently, and this prevents the attack from going through. So the conditional access policy will say, meh, no, you are not compliant, you are not hyper-joined, whatever, you cannot access this resource, and therefore you don't get a cookie at all.
Right, understood. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess, because you mentioned Defender for Cloud Apps, which is an awesome point. So for example, if the adversary in the middle is able to, I go through my adversary in the middle attack and conditional access routes me through Defender for Cloud Apps, so I'm through the reverse proxy. Can they repurpose what they've stolen in any other way that isn't Defender for Cloud Apps, or will the adversary only be limited to the session that's been allowed through that?
Yeah, there is some gray area there.
Right.
So Defender for Cloud Apps, if the service that you are accessing behind is not exposing any kind of access key directly to the end user, then this is safe, because then you are communicating with the Defender for Cloud Apps and this communication is safe. But if for any reason the service behind this will expose some kind of like access token in the URL maybe or something, and the attacker can take this access token and access the website without.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So there are ways around. And currently, Defender for Cloud Apps cannot prevent this if the application is not trying to protect this data sent over correctly, doing like cookies and stuff like that. And if it's exposed in some way, then you can work around.
Right. Awesome. No, that's really useful information. And like you said, you know, you mentioned hybrid join and compliance. So at the end of the day, that's just certificates. It's like all of this is just certificates all the way down. You know, it's
there's so much certificates. And if you join a machine to Azure AD and you're looking at what certificates this machine now has, it's really crazy. So there's a certificate for this and for that. And this makes the certificates and the private keys of those so important. So a TPM says, everybody was like, oh no, Windows 11, now we have to use TPM. Mm-hmm. And I can understand for somebody who is playing Call of Duty at home, it's not really logical that the new Windows 11 has to have a TPM. But Microsoft now can say to everybody in the enterprise environment, you have to have TPM, otherwise you can't use this operating system.
Yeah.
It doesn't make the operating system per se secure, but it will secure those artifacts like a certificate more securely, because if they are bound to a TPM, it's much harder to get them out. Yeah. There are attacks for, like, I think we all have seen this BitLocker attacks on TPM where somebody is like soldering stuff on the name of, it will happen. But if this is now the attack vector, you have to get a hold of the machine and you have to boot it up and try to extract something from this machine that way. This raises the bar immensely for the attacker. And it's not that easy, like having some Trojan.exe on the machine and being able to extract just the certificates, send them over and use them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like you said, it increases the cost to the attacker, but it also goes back to that point that, you know, the vast majority of attacks that the vast majority of organizations have to be concerned about, they aren't physical attacks, right? Those things will always exist. You'll always have the risk of that. But the ones that are really flooring organizations with regards to ransomware and compromise and data breaches, you know, they're not getting anywhere near your physical devices, right? They're doing it
all online. They are somewhere far away. They don't want to get near to you.
Right. Yes. Again, because that's risk, and attackers, they also would like to minimize their risk. Absolutely. Okay. That's awesome. I think that's going to give folks a lot of food for thought with regards to identity security. But I'll tell you what, one of the other things I also want to talk with you about is Defender for Endpoint a little bit, because, well, number one, we just had the, and I'm going to be able to put this up on the screen, hopefully, we just had the authors of this awesome
book.
Oh,
you got the printed copy already. Nice.
I did, yeah. I'm a sucker for printed copies. I don't know. I like to sit down in bed and read it, like, because that's what we do, right? We read books about EDRs. I wanted to talk to you about a few things in that, because you've done a tremendous amount of research really with regards to two core things that are very important but very overlooked in MDE. And they both got a common theme. They both got this common theme of bypasses, right? Because I look at the work you've done with regards to how Defender for Endpoint handles exclusions. And I also look at the work you've done with regards to how Defender for Endpoint tamper protection works. And I'll say for both of these, before we get into any more detail, based on your research, Microsoft have improved a lot of stuff, right? So I think that needs to be called out. That's good, right? One, insofar as it's good for you because you're making an impact, but it's also good for Microsoft insofar as showing that they respond to the feedback. Tamper protection now is far more encompassing than it used to be. And exclusions now, in some respect, protected by tamper protection. There's also far more clarity about how those work than maybe there was a year or two ago. So I guess if I tackle MDE exclusions first, what was it kind of sent you down that rabbit hole of figuring out how it works? Because for those of you that aren't, most folks listening to this will probably be Defender people. But for those of you that aren't, you know, defender exclusions are not simple, at least not yet. So what got you down that research path?
Yeah, I think the initial starting point was trying to really understand where the Microsoft Defender antivirus and the Microsoft Defender for endpoint exclusions had overlapping stuff. Because, as you said, I did testing on tamper protection, stuff like that. And then it's always about trying to figure out how I can bypass maybe something and execute some malware on the machine while still having MDE running. And exclusions is the perfect attack. Because if you make your antivirus blind on purpose and you can say, don't look at this folder and all the processes in there, that's perfect. And then I have seen weird behavior, I would call it, or in the beginning, weird behavior, because I executed a file and antivirus was completely fine. Yeah, do that. You told me not to look here. But a few minutes later, this process was killed and the file was removed by Defender antivirus. And I was like, okay, why is that? Why is this happening? And how are the different exclusions within MDE working together with MDAV? And how do they interact in a whole together to protect you? And then I started, okay, let's look at what all those exclusions are, what is important to know about those, and where can I use them, and when should I use them. And while doing that, I have had like 500 tabs open, because all this information is out there. It's Microsoft has done a tremendous job in the last 10 years with docs and now learnmicrosoft.com. It's great. It's a great resources and great people writing there. And sometimes it's just a bit more scattered than you want to have it. And this was the reason for me to say, okay, I want to get all this information and put it in one place. And if somebody wants to have a good overview and more than just the surface, they can look at this. And definitely Microsoft will have more in-depth knowledge in their product specific documentation on some things, but then they still can jump over there and have a look, especially at that. And the second thing that moved me in that direction to do the work was that I have seen so many questions around it. Everybody is like, how does it work? Why do I need to do this exclusion here? And how will this impact that? And yeah, so I thought, okay, this is something not only I am enjoying, but maybe some people out there as well.
Yep, absolutely. And so I guess, is there a short version of this that folks should know? Because, you know, just to be clear, for those of you that haven't had the joy of playing with Defender for Endpoint Exclusions, there's not just one page that you do this in, right? If I want to exclude a file from Defender for Endpoint, what do I do? Where do I start?
So if you really want to exclude it, there are two ways. The easiest way above all is to create a so-called allow indicator within Microsoft Defender for Endpoint. So you go to securitymicrosoft.com. You first extract the SHA hash for this file, and then you go configuration, Defender, and put in an allow indicator. So this might be counterintuitive. An indicator of compromise, as we normally call them, is something bad. But in that case, it's just an indicator of something, and we want to allow it in every case. And doing that, this is the highest exclusion you can ever get. Because now MDE, MDAV, and all the systems that are onboarded to your tenant will allow this file to run, regardless of what this file does. So if it's some hacker tool, yeah, it will run. And you don't even have to create exclusions on the endpoint, because the endpoint will always first check with the cloud and is like, ah, no, this is allowed. I will allow to run it. So this is the highest exclusion that you can make. The next best thing is you would exclude some folder like your research folder from automatic investigations and create a folder exclusion for Microsoft Defender AV. But now you have two products, and this is where it gets complicated. You have to do it in the one portal there, and for creating an exclusion on your endpoints, this can be either GPO, it can be Intune, maybe some other SCCM, whatever you have, and to configure this. And in the end, this is also where it gets complicated for people to implement it. And Microsoft is doing a tremendous work to getting this configuration in the cloud. So we now have the cloud attached for servers at last. Yep. So we now can configure group policies for servers in the cloud in Intune, but it's not really Intune and you don't need a license. But it's amazing, because if you go this route and you are like, I want to go in the cloud, now you have the capability to manage more and more of those security settings completely in the cloud, and you don't have to rely on stuff like on-premises GPOs to do that.
Yeah. No, good point about Intune, because it's, you're managing it in the Intune admin center, but if you use that, it's not Intune that's actually doing it, because Intune's an MDM and you're not Intune enrolling your servers. It gets complicated, right?
Yes.
And so I get, because the other thing that you can manage through Intune or through the tenant settings that you just mentioned is tamper protection, right? You can do it per device using Intune. You can't do it using group policy or config manager. It's purely Intune or the tenant settings. And again, that's another thing that you've done a lot of research into. The whole point of tamper protection is to stop folks turning off MDAV or circumventing MDAV in some kind of way. But again, in your research in the early days, there were quite a few bypasses, let's just call them what they are, to that. You know, it didn't protect exclusions and a number of other things. I think default action for threats was another one it didn't protect, which meant it didn't protect anything really. How has tamper protection changed over time? So, you know, there have been a number of improvements.
Definitely.
What's the state of it now?
So I think one of the main things that Microsoft wanted to achieve with tamper protection was, again, to set the bar higher for the attacker. So what we see in many ransomware attacks is like, set MP preferences, disable real-time protection. And now your complete antivirus solution is like, I don't scan anymore if you don't say do a full scan. That's bad. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft didn't have any way to protect against such attacks in the beginning. And then they were like, we need tamper protection. And tamper protection protected certain settings and configurations of Microsoft Defender Antivirus that allowed nobody to change them. So even the administrator on the system wasn't able to now disable Defender Antivirus or do certain settings within Defender Antivirus that would lower the protection value. And over the time, Microsoft added more and more settings to that. So now sometimes I get to customers and they have like group policies sending out some configuration. And I'm like, that's all nice and good. But since you have tamper protection enabled, those settings, they won't apply. Right. They will apply. It looks like it, but they won't change anything. Something like network protection is now protected by tamper protection. So, and Microsoft changed over the last, 3 years in small increments, but important increments, which settings they are protecting. And now we are at the point, and this is, amazing, we now can protect exclusions from tamper protection. And this was something impossible for like most of the time, because exclusions, it was still this open area. You could go in as an administrator, adjust say, yeah, I want to exclude this folder and this, even I could say exclude C, and the whole C drive would be excluded. And now I'm finally in have the ability to say, no, you cannot, even as an administrator, change the exclusions of this system anymore. And this really ups the game, because now an attacker really has to think, how can they bypass this? Before that, we had something like crew policies, and this also helped because it meant, okay, I can send you a new configuration every half an hour, or not send, you will retrieve a configuration every half an hour and apply it, and it will remove certain stuff. And I have this setting like local admin merge disabled, so it's not that easy to put in my own exclusions, but there are still ways around it. Microsoft has tightened that up now really good with tempo protection.
Great.
But as you said it, you in some cases need Intune to configure those advanced hardened settings. And this makes it a bit unreachable for some customers out there in regards of like servers. And so I hope that Microsoft will do more in that area to even the playing field, even for all servers on premises.
Yep. Yeah, because it's one of those things that I look at it, and I'll be honest, when I do Defender for Endpoint projects, I talk to my customers and I say, you know what, this is also a good opportunity for you, frankly, to do a whole Intune project and get your devices enrolled there so you can get those benefits. That's easier said than done for a lot of folks, right? So it would be good if you could do it through other means. And just to clarify one thing that might startle some folks, you mentioned how as soon as you turn on tamper protection, you can't change any settings. So all those group policies you mentioned, nothing happens with those. Does that mean, for example, if I'm in Intune and I say, okay, well, I'm going to add some exclusions using Intune, or I'm going to change the scan frequency using Intune, does that mean I need to completely disable tamper protection? Or how should folks think about that?
No, I think first and foremost, it's important to understand it's not all the settings. So it's not like everything that you configured is now not applying anymore. So it's stuff that really would set your security level back. So I think one of the latest additions was the disabling of archive and network file scanning. Microsoft enables this now by default if you have tamper protection enabled. And some of my customers were like, okay, now I have this setting and it doesn't work anymore. Yeah, that's because of tamper protection. But stuff like I want to have a quick scan every now and then, and this is not tamper protection and not tamper protected, and I hope it never will be because it doesn't make sense. But to have these core settings protected by tamper protection, this makes totally sense. And as you can see, Microsoft is also increasing the security baseline with those tamper protection additions. But of course, when we are now talking about something like servers, and we have enabled tamper protection not within Intune and send it to our Windows clients, but we enabled it tenant-wide, and we are saying, yep, every client that is onboarded to MDE is tamper protected. Now I have a problem if I want to do it on like my 2019 server or even 2016 server, and I want to change one of those settings. And Microsoft has now introduced the troubleshooting mode, and this allows you to temporarily for 4 hours disable the ability to disable tamper protection. Yeah, so it does not immediately turn off tamper protection on the device, but now you can turn on tamper protection using PowerShell. So if you start this mode, this troubleshooting mode, your administrator can now go there and say, okay, disable tamper protection, and now let me try to add this and that exclusion, look if the performance of my business application is now like I wanted to have, or if this exclusion wasn't the reason, it was something else. And after the 4 hours, Microsoft will roll back all the changes made in those 4 hours automatically. and go to the state before temple protection enabled. So this gives you like 4 hours of investigation time to figure out, is it some kind of exclusion I have to make or whatever setting? And then afterwards, you then can implement those settings doing in Intune or GPO on the servers and send them to the server for future use.
Right, gotcha. So it's a kind of, like you said, it's that testing interval, and it doesn't disable tamper protection unless I choose to disable tamper protection. That's a manual execution to do that.
I think right? That's something where you have to spin your head around at the beginning because disabling something, but it's not really the tamper protection. You have the opportunity to disable tamper protection with troubleshooting mode.
Yes, that's it. Yep. Yeah. Nothing's ever simple with Defender for Endpoint. But hey, it's getting there. It's becoming much more approachable, especially if you've got Defender for Business. It's a nice little, it makes things a little bit easier through the UI. I could do this for like, I think I said to you before, I could do this for like 5 hours. I get so much stuff to work through, but we should probably wrap up. We'll maybe get you back for part two at another point. It's been awesome having you join me because I've learned more stuff, and I think folks are going to get a ton of value with regards to securing their identities and learning a little bit more about how Defender for Endpoint works under the hood there. Do you have anything to hype, promote, or where can folks find you online if they want to?
So you will find me on Twitter, Fabian_Bader, or just visit my blog, cloudbrothers.info, and there you will find all my online presences, LinkedIn, Mastodon, wherever you want to reach out to me. And also, if you want to reach out, please feel free, just send me an email, DM. All is open. And if I find the time, I will answer. Sometimes it takes a bit, but I try to be open there and not only share on my blog, but also in private if you have questions.
Awesome. Good stuff. And your blog is in both English and German, is that correct?
Yeah, it was for a long time also in German, but maintaining two languages.
That's a lot of work.
Looking at my viewership, it's mostly English speaking folks. So I settled on English because those people in Germany that want to read it, they mostly speak English as well. So yep. Yeah. Cool. But if you have a German and you have one particular blog post that you want to have translated, reach out to me. We can figure something out.
And then they can buy you a coffee, right? Because you can buy
of course.
A coffee on his website. So go ahead and do that. Right. So we'll link to your blog. We'll link to all your social media in the show notes. If anyone's listening and wants to pick those up easily, they'll be in the description and in the notes. Like I said, it's been awesome catching up with you. Hopefully it won't be the last time. I'll close the show by saying, you know, please like, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. Obey the algorithm overlords. They help us promote the show tremendously if you subscribe to us, comment, all that good stuff. So, Fabian Bader, thanks for joining us. Catch you later.
Thank you for having me.